Michael Molnar, and during the 1980s and 1990s, I was in charge of the archive at the Freud Museum in London. A certain moment in the, I think in the mid-1990s, when email began to become usual, I started getting these research queries by email. They were curious, they were fizzing with enthusiasm and the joys of research, and I came to look forward to them. Of course, they were from John Forrester, and what I most valued about them was not so much the inquiry itself as the follow-up. He would always, after I'd given him my penny's worth or farthing's worth of data that I could dig out of the archive, he would come back and explain why he had made this request, and then he would go off on some marvelous riff or free association of what this research meant and where it was leading and so on. I'll have to give you some example of this. So this is already in 2001, and he's deep into Freud in Cambridge research. And he wanted me to trawl up whatever I could find on Frank Ramsey, Ray Monk, Pridram, question mark, Albert Francis or Carl Pridram. And I dug up hardly anything, and then I got this, I'll quote, "I've discovered more treasure trove, particularly on Ramsey, in King's, where I was a fellow. Strange how this project is continually bringing me back to my old haunts, even my own rooms. The things one finds out. Susan Isaacs lived at One Hoop Chambers, Bridge Street, Cambridge, in 1924 when she moved there. And Ramsey moved in a year later with his new wife. Connection? Geoffrey and Margaret Pike is my bet. Geoffrey rented Strachey's flat at 41 Gordon Square while Strachey's were in Vienna with Freud. And then Keynes rented it off Geoffrey. Then Geoffrey moved to Cambridge and started the Malting House School. He made a fortune speculating in tin. The things one does." End of quote. Now that tells us all sorts of things, not only about John's style of research, but about his style of emailing. Here he is taking the lid off a historic anthill, exposing all this hidden scurrying underneath. And the idiosyncratic part is that this picture, of course, includes his own pleasures in his discoveries and his desire to share them. And underneath that, there's other undertones. There's the amusement, if you like, at how strangely the work has turned out to connect with his own life. And then this mixture of bewilderment, if you like, of the things one finds out and the things one does. From quite early on, John recognized in me another picker-up of unconsidered trifles. And after a time, I even started to get competitive in this email correspondence over who could dig up the most obscure information. So in 2004, when he was researching Einstein, I got this email from him. I quote, this is John, not me, John. "My latest piece of antiquarianism is to muse on the conversations between Friedrich Adler and Albert Einstein in 1898 in Zurich, with Adler telling Einstein about the apartment he lived in for the first 13 years of his life, 19 Berggasse, and the rivalrous chap who moved in after the Adlers left. Did you know that Friedrich stood down from the competition for a post in Zurich in 1912? I think that's the date, maybe earlier, so that Einstein could have it, since Einstein deserved it more. This is the same Adler who assassinated the Austrian Prime Minister in 1916. Einstein was always very supportive of him, even though he privately thought he was too much of an ideological physicist, too much Mach. But I ramble," end of quote. This is typical John rambling. Now, in that spirit of rambling, I thought I could outdo him here, because I'd come across Brazilian journal an article that John couldn't have come across about a doctor nutritionist called Silva Mello, who apparently gave Einstein a meal of feijoada, which is the Brazilian national dish with beans, rice, and meat. And that was when Einstein was in Rio. So I emailed that vital piece of information. And in this rambling spirit, I couldn't stop myself adding that this Silva Mello had apparently had a theory that the ovaries and testicles could be damaged by excesses of noise and light. Now, this Silva Mello lived long enough to see the rise of the Beatles, and he accused them of causing damage to the heartbeat of humanity. Now, I happen to be a bit allergic to loud noise myself, so I added, "A man after my own heart." John's reply began, quote, "Great stuff. Einstein's visit was, I think, in 1923 in the course of his grand world tour when the Japanese went ape over him. Strange fads and fashions in the early 20s. Then, in this rambling spirit, John goes on to speculate about the identity of the woman in an obscure case of Freud, a case of successful treatment by hypnotism in 1992-3. And then, out of the blue, in the final line of the email, and a quote, "And I take your disparagement of the Beatles personally." So this was for me another side of John Forrester, as any other child of the 60s, but can't help recognizing that's an allusion to Bob Dylan album. He'll come in due course. Now, since 1998, I was on the editorial board of the journal Psychoanalysis and History. In 2005, John replaced Andrea Sabatini as the editor. And when he was about to take over, he and I had a meeting, and he asked me how the journal would run. So I said, you know, the editorial board would meet at the house of one of their number, and there would be tea and biscuits and discussion. He gives me a sort of quizzical look, and I read into that yes, committees, he knew enough about that, and he said no, he didn't think he would be running the journal that way, and he didn't. He ran it by email, in fact, and as a result of it, I've got this archive of John's emails, which is the basis of what I'm going to be giving you now, including lengthy quotes from John. I want to give him more of a voice than myself. So I, in order to prepare for this talk, reread this archive, just to jog my memory, of course, but I was also looking in the secret hope of finding some aspect of him that I'd need not ignored or neglected before. This is in the spirit of Nachträglichkeit, I suppose, which John discusses at length in Language and the Origins of Psychoanalysis. Well, I did come across this one extract that certainly takes on a deferred or nachträglich resonance, though a sad one, I'm afraid. In 2012, I reviewed the German edition of Freud's letters to his fiancée and corrected an editorial mistake where the editors referred to Golders Green Crematorium, they footnoted as being part of a Jewish cemetery. This is how John responded. Quote, "Given what the German editors say in the Jewish part of the London cemetery at Golders Green, I think it's worth emphasizing that the Golders Green crematorium is neither Jewish nor a cemetery. Your sentence doesn't quite make that clear. It's one of the principal crematoria of London. In fact, it's the first to be built in London. The crematoria movement were explicitly opposed to cemeteries." Then he streamed down a hole stack of information from Wikipedia on the crematorium movement, and ends this way, quote, "It is estimated that the crematorium now averages around 2,000 cremations a year. At Golders Green, the funerals of many prominent people have taken place over the last century." That's the proper context for Freud's cremation. "Perhaps I should add, both my parents were cremated there. It's highly likely that I will be as well." End of quote. Now, one reason I'm quoting that is because of what happened later on that day. A few hours later, I received the following email, quote, "An extraordinary Freudian slip, realized as soon as I pressed send. My father was not cremated at Golders Green Crematorium, though my mother was, in 1985. He was cremated somewhere anonymous near New York City, where he died suddenly. A memorial service was held for him at Golders Green Crematorium a few weeks after he died, which I couldn't attend because I was in the States studying at Princeton. But my mother had left me the urn containing his ashes when she returned from New York City to London. So on the day of his memorial service, I went out into the New Jersey countryside and scattered his ashes in a river. I didn't know which it was at the time, being a stranger to the land, but established later that it was the Delaware, close by where George Washington crossed. Stories often need correction." End of quote. So what strikes me about these emails is this and other emails of his, is that how seamlessly the business aspect slips into free association. And at the same time, how Freud studies seamlessly merge into autobiography. I was delighted when John became editor of Psychoanalysis and History, because it was founded, the journal was founded by Bob Inchwood, an analyst historian. And for the first years, the editorial board was all psychoanalysts except for me, so I would be very much the outsider at these editorial meetings. And I was always worried that the psychoanalysis of the title would come to heavily predominate over the history aspect of it. With John, I felt now we were home and dry, now we were in touch with a whole network, the mainstream of cultural and historical studies. That was my feeling. I mean, when you start looking at it more closely, my sense of the situation might have been a little suspect. Now, rereading John's emails and looking back at his work, I find myself finding a new slant on his attitude and his sense of psychoanalytic historiography. If you take his first book, The Language and Origins of Psychoanalysis, that's from 1980, the first thing that catches the reader's attention there is the epigraph to the opening chapter, which is a long quote from Bob Dylan's The Gates of Eden. Now, given the academic norms of the time, or maybe today, that's certainly a provocation, and in my eyes, a very welcome provocation. That's the first impression. Now, coming back to that book, now half a lifetime later, and that half lifetime having been spent in the Freud universe, what does catch my attention, a curious sentence that opens the book's conclusion, quote, "It will not have passed unnoticed that it will not be easy to find this book a disciplinary niche," end of quote. I think Andreas has quoted something similar item from this book. But I call this sentence curious because the construction is so awkward. Get a repeated negative, not unnoticed, not easy, two adjectives modified by a quasi-denial. The very form seems to mimic unease or discomfort. This is Unbehagen. And he ends the book saying, "I've tried to do nothing other than write the history of the present. In history, as in psychoanalysis, one understands what comes before through what comes after." So that's a very simply stated conclusion. It's a Nachträglichkeit, or deferred action in a nutshell, but it's nothing less than a lifetime's project. Now, 25 years after that, when John became editor of 2005 of Psychoanalysis and History, he took a sort of brief overview of his chosen field of studies in the inaugural editorial. I'll quote from that. "It is over 30 years since I started research on a doctoral dissertation on the history of psychoanalysis. The field was not then, and is not now, one with recognized boundaries, canonical texts, exemplary studies. It was, and remains, riven with controversy. It is heterogeneous, porous to outsiders, rife with self-appointed insiders, displaying manifold tensions between psychoanalyst historians and writers from a wide range of other disciplinary backgrounds, including enthusiasts of no fixed intellectual." Now, you wonder where he put himself on that list. I mean, on the face of it, you can't get more of an insider than him, obviously. Or more fixed intellectual abode than he had here in Cambridge University history for science. When you start looking at his other coordinates, where he came from, I mean, not just Princeton, Kuhn, then Paris, Lacan, Derrida, Foucault, you get not so much a fixed intellectual abode as an intellectual odyssey. And in fact, that's what he does sketch out in the preface to The Seductions of Psychoanalysis. In which introduction he also makes a point of mentioning the cultural marginality of psychoanalysis in Great Britain. Now, that marginality and the reasons for it are obviously of great interest to a cultural historian. And what I became interested in reading this email archive of mine was John's own involvement and investment in marginality. And that ties in with his recurrent bouts of amusement, bemusement, at his own intellectual situation. He seems to be subliminally always asking himself the question again and again, how on earth did I get here? And where is here? In the year 2000, he submitted his first contribution to Psychoanalysis and History. This was Tansley's Psychoanalytic Network, episode out of the early history of psychoanalysis in England, which is co-written with Laura Cameron. And he refers to her in the email I'm going to quote now. I thanked him for the submission, and I said, I thank you for your weird and wonderful submission. And I got this response: "Dear Michael, weird and wonderful. I think your epithets for the Psychoanalysis and History paper are very accurate indeed. Between you and me, I think the weird and wonderful, perhaps eccentric strands and way into the material comes in part from the weird and wonderful folk talked about it, but also from my rather remarkable collaborator on it. I'm still very pleased about it." Now, of course, weird and wonderful is just a set phrase that I've just casually thrown in, but I was writing it formally, but I still stand by it today, and I accept his amendment too, eccentric. Could even add sort of semi-homophones for wayward, for example. But I find the fact that he fixed on that expression quite significant, because as our correspondence progressed, the weirdness of Freud scholarship would become a sort of leitmotif. Here's just a little aside from some email on some unrelated topic a few years later. Quote, "Interesting how folk whiz across the sky of Freud scholarship and then disappear. My first version close to home, that one, was Frank Soloway. Now he was seriously weird." critic Harold Bloom's review of Janet Malcolm's In the Freud Archive, he speaks of her as a sort of Alice in Wonderland in this crazy world of scholarship. So, I mean, time and time again in these emails, I'm coming across a sort of email equivalent of a raised eyebrow on John's behalf. I mean, in one case, he simply concludes that a certain well-known scholar writing about translation was mad. Now, in Freud biography, as many will here know, especially as practiced by Ernest Jones, there's a fine tradition of finding your opponent mad. That's one thing, but there's also the phenomenon the French call déformation professionnelle, or Shakespeare calls the dyer's hand, which is becoming infected when one becomes infected by one's environment. A lifetime in the world of Freud scholarship must leave its marks. Alternatively, like those door plates that office workers like. You don't have to be mad to work here, but it helps. So I will end with the last of John's autobiographical free associations from my archive. It's dated 26th of February 2015. That year, John, Matt Fitch and I were collaborating on a critical edition of Beyond the Pleasure Principle for Psychoanalysis and History. To translate a footnote, I needed to get hold of both the German and the English editions of Ilse Rubensivitis's sort of Back to Freud's Texts. And I knew that John would almost certainly have both of them. So I asked him to dig them out for me. This was his reply. Quote, "After hours of going over and over my bookshelves, sure the English translation of Zurück was there, I'd happily fallen upon the German, which I'd not expected to find, believing it wrongly to be stranded in Cambridge, I finally found it. It was the wrong colour. I was sure it was yellowish and black. No, it's dark green. The German is standard whitish with red and black lettering. Why do I use colours to identify books when it's a hopeless guy? So I now do have both the German and English versions on my desk to use in correlating your reference." Now we got the riff. When I was 12 or 13, I read Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle. It was a truly mind-opening experience. I decided I wanted more. I decided that the best guarantee of finding books in the public library that were of the same quality as Cat's Cradles would be that they were yellow, the old Victor Goeitz formula. Though at that point in time, I hadn't learned that different books were published by different publishers. So for a few weeks, I read nothing but yellow books. It turned out, empirically, that this was not a guarantee of von Goethean quality. I once met von Goethe and told him this story. He thought I was weird. I knew he would think that. But being weird in von Goethe's eyes must be a kind of achievement. End of quote. There's a little coda, which I'll finish on, to that email ramble. A few weeks ago, I was sitting on a bench on the South Bank with my nephew, and I was discussing what I would talk about today, and I said, weirdness will have to come into it somewhere. And at that moment, a young girl sits down next to us. She's holding a book, and the book is von Goethe. Now, as often, I find myself wondering, what would